From Washington, this is the HPS Macrocast with Hamilton Place Strategies and Markets Policy Partners.
Good morning. It's Friday, July 23rd, and you're listening to the HPS Macrocast. I'm Brian DeAngelis, a managing director at Hamilton Place Strategies, filling in for Tony Fratto this week, and I'm here with John Fagan and Brendan Walsh from Market Policy Partners. And we have a special guest today for our first segment, Norman Anderson. Norman is the chairman and CEO of CGLA Infrastructure, a firm focused on U.S. and global infrastructure development, especially new infrastructure productivity and opportunity. He also oversees Blueprint 2025, a group of leading public and private entities focused on doubling the size of infrastructure investment in the U.S. And his recent book, Vision, Our Strategic Infrastructure Roadmap Forward, has been called a model for the Biden infrastructure plan, which is on everyone's minds these days in Washington. So Norman, welcome to the Macrocast. We're excited to have you on.
Hey, thanks, Brian. Appreciate it. Look forward to speaking to you guys.
Well, let's jump right into it. Give us your take on kind of how this infrastructure plan in Congress has at least started to come together. I'd love your view on whether this is enough, not enough, just what they can stomach right now. Give us your sense of kind of where we are in the debate.
No, that's great. And, you know, it'll be good to, I'm going to give a short introduction and be interesting to hear from John and Brendan. Look, you know, one of the things that's happened, I think there are three things that I look at. One of them is hanging over this whole thing, and you could have predicted this from the very beginning, is the debt problem, right? We've got $30 trillion in debt. So all of a sudden this week, people are having trouble figuring out what the pay fors are. And a lot of the things that they had in mind, like higher IRS tax collection rates and $150 billion in PPPs, are sort of sliding off the table. And so that is creating a huge amount of stress. The other piece that I think is creating an enormous amount of stress is what you alluded to at the beginning. Infrastructure is increasingly technology driven. We're digitizing and electrifying the economy at the speed of light. And I'm not sure that the reference that people have in their minds, that politicians have in their minds about bridges, roads, and tunnels is really a powerful referent in terms of what we're really looking at, because we're really looking at electric vehicles, renewable energy. Hydrogen is coming to the fore really quickly, and it's becoming a really interesting topic as well. Plus all the other things we talk about, the rollout of 5G and the implementation of 5G and people taking advantage of that. Autonomy is starting to drive a lot of thinking around infrastructure as well. So you've got those two issues. And a third issue, which I find fascinating, is that older people, people of retirement age, are much more intensely interested in infrastructure and infrastructure investment than young people. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But I think that one of the big issues is how we define infrastructure. I mean, is it really everything, including all the social infrastructure that the Biden administration talks about, or is it much more narrowly focused on things that are going to drive competitiveness, drive economic growth, and drive equity and opportunity at the same time, plus address, which is a huge theme over the last 2 weeks, global warming, which kind of fell off the table in terms of the bipartisan infrastructure bill.
Yeah, I'm interested when you talk about that age gap. I've noticed that as well. And I think that's been true probably for some time now. But younger audience, they care about climate change. They care about some of the issues where they feel government is failing. But I feel like on innovation, they sort of almost have a little bit of a free market look where they see companies doing this anyway, and they don't quite appreciate the role government plays in kind of spurring some of that along. Am I right on that take?
Yeah, I think you're right across the board on that. And one of the things, going back to your original question, you know, if you're talking about $1.2 trillion in infrastructure investment, there's another $1 trillion that Brendan and I have talked about that comes from private investment anyway, and that's renewable energy, solar, wind, et cetera, and increasingly hydrogen. And one of the things that, we find interesting about hydrogen, just to put that on everybody's map, is that hydrogen works where there aren't any wires. And if you look at the middle of the country, the middle of the country just lights up with wind opportunities and solar opportunities. The cost is getting those electrons to the coasts. But if you were to generate green hydrogen, then you can ship it through pipelines or, you know, charge trucks, freight vehicles, et cetera. And all of a sudden, you've got a clean fuel that you can distribute around the country much more economically. So there's issues like that. But going back to your point about the age gap, I think you're absolutely right. I think there's a much greater concern with global warming, and it doesn't really come together with building roads and bridges. Yeah. It's quite the opposite. And one of the things that we're spending a lot of time on is trying to figure out, if you were to build more roads and bridges, how do you build them in a green way? How do you build them so that you're not taking 80%, let's say, of a new highway is cement and steel, and you can use either green cement and green steel, or you can use cheap cement and cheap steel, which usually is produced by coal-fired processes, and all of a sudden you've got a big carbon footprint, much bigger carbon footprint than you should have. So there's just a huge discussion that's not happening.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to bring John and Brendan into this. Go ahead, John. I think you're jumping in.
Yeah. Sorry. I was chomping at the bit to ask a question. I think this is all absolutely fascinating. And one of the things that we talked about before is this is a completely different approach to infrastructure than we've had, or perhaps should be thought of as a completely different approach to infrastructure than we've had certainly in my lifetime. There was no quote unquote infrastructure policy that I can remember other than fix what needs fixing. The kind of, you know, the values and the vision, which is the title of your book, that is baked into the American Jobs Plan, is kind of by definition requires a top-down orchestration and the sort of piecemeal fashion of the old way, which is you just take money allocated by Congress for infrastructure, dump it on the states and say, go for it, folks, you know, fix what needs fixing, isn't compatible with this infrastructure campaign, this multi-decade effort to try to refurbish and upgrade our infrastructure in a future facing way. How do you impose that vision on this sprawling multi-front infrastructure campaign?
So what we find, John, is that people are very willing to have that vision imposed on them. You know, what's going on is that there's no conversation, which is just fascinating. So you've got to come up with a way to drive the conversation. I think that comes from the White House. And the idea that there's not an infrastructure office in the White House is that's you can't have a major initiative to transform the American economy without having an infrastructure office in the White House with people who are really fluent in what Brian was getting at. People who are really good at advanced technology and environmental goods, at driving both competitiveness and equity and creativity and opportunity. You know, you've got to have that. I'm fascinated by that. The other piece that we've talked about a lot is you've got to bring a different source of funding to the game. All of the pay-fors in the bipartisan bill that were invented, as far as I could tell, have now been moved out of their spreadsheet boxes, right? They're gone. And you know, the one thing that's there is bringing the future into the infrastructure conversation by bringing pension funds into that conversation. So you bring something like 10% of our $30 trillion in pension funds, you bring those into a disciplined investment strategy that invests in the kinds of things that we want to have. Pension funds want to invest 30 years and they want to get something above their actuarial return targets, you know, 8%. That's easy to do in infrastructure almost across the board. But what I find increasingly interesting is that would also give people a sense of ownership, which would be phenomenal. It would also give people a much stronger voice in terms of what our infrastructure priorities are. And it would give a different generation a stronger voice. That's kind of the piece that's needed. Right now we have, you know, 80 and 90 year olds driving our infrastructure decision making. And these are third-tier assets, right? So it naturally doesn't make that much sense. Bringing in 30 year olds to drive our infrastructure decision making would seem to be a lot more dynamically interesting.
When you talk about getting private money and pension money into US infrastructure projects, there's just in Washington, D.C., there's a lot of defeatism about that. Certainly they have that model overseas, but there's a consensus that it's not compatible with the U.S. model. Why hasn't the U.S. been successful in marshaling private capital to infrastructure thus far? And what needs to change for that to be successful?
You know, one of the things that I think a lot is that this kind of thing happens when you have disruptive leadership. This isn't a management issue. This is a paradigm change issue. You know, the Canadians did this 20 years ago, and now their average pension fund invests more than 10% of their assets directly into infrastructure projects. And they have mid-teens returns on those projects. So, you know, it really is a leadership issue. And, you know, you have to, I think what happens, John, is you decide as a country, you know, it's the Winston Churchill thing about democracies. You decide as a country that we've tried everything and it didn't work. This is the last thing we get to try. And I'm just trying to speed up the process. So we recognize that we're not going to raise the gasoline tax. We're not going to charge electric vehicles some phenomenal amount of money for using the highways. We're not going to invent money through PPPs or find additional money to get out of the IRS. So there's got to be a different pot of money that we use, a different way that we do this. It's not going to be through user fees because those tend to be dramatically regressive. So it has to be through our future savings. That's where this has to come from. And it's a disruptive leadership issue.
Likewise, Norman, I guess fear as someone who's interested in these issues that, you know, even if Democrats are completely successful here, they get their best case scenario and it's $4.5 trillion of investment.
Good luck with that, by the way, just good luck with that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But even if that happens, we may not revisit this again for another 20 years. And it took so much to even get us here. How do you, or what advice, I don't know how to frame the question quite, but how do we make this a priority for the country kind of every year instead of just these kind of big decade long kind of pushes?
Well, I'm a big fan of actually this initial $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill, because I think it's a start. I don't think it's a defeat. I don't think it's anything but a start. And it opens up the conversation in the right way, because it doesn't get us. It's not a finish line conversation like you're alluding to. It's a start. And one of the things that we're seeing all across the country as I visit people is that they're looking for guidance and they're seeing opportunities and they're sensing that as we move into this sort of fourth industrial revolution and the digitization, electrification of the economy, that, you know, decisions that they make right now that are going to be 5, 10, 15 year decisions, they're not sure about how to make those decisions. And I think that's an interesting role for government. It's an interesting role for pension funds. It's a critical role for pension funds to play in determining the future. And especially, Brian, you know, if you look at what's happened when you've gone through these wrenching changes before, creates an enormous amount of instability, which, you know, guess what? That's really what we're seeing right now. An infrastructure investment and the right kind of investment that brings people together rather than divides them that tends to create stability. And that's really what we need right now. We're also spending a lot of time, just to raise this maybe for the next podcast, on looking at how to help the world recover from COVID. And a big piece of that is infrastructure investment. And a big piece of that's going to be the digitization, electrification, the wiring up of the global economy. Otherwise, because, you know, we live in a bubble right now where we're recovering from COVID. Most countries are right in the middle of it.
We're not, right.
And they don't have the resources that we had to recover. So somebody's got to get up above that picture and figure out how to bring the whole world along. Otherwise, we really do have a troubling decade in front of us. And, you know, one of the few ways to do that is significant infrastructure investment in the right areas.
I would love to continue this conversation, but I know we're running out of time. Norman, we'd love to have you back on and talk about that some more. This has been fascinating, and I appreciate John and Brendan inviting you on today. And I've added another book, I guess, to my summer reading list. So I encourage all our listeners to check out Vision. And I really appreciate your thoughts this morning. This has been great.
Great. Nice talking to you guys. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Norman. And we'll take a break here. And when we come back, we'll discuss next week's Fed meetings and this week's turbulent stock market performance. You're listening to the HPS Macrocast.
Markets Policy Partners provides sophisticated financial market analysis that is independent, accessible, and actionable for a broad audience. Learn more at marketspolicy.com. or visit them on Twitter at Markets Policy.
And we're back with the HPS Macrocast. Brian DeAngelis here filling in for Tony Fratto. And as always, we're with John Fagan and Brendan Walsh of Market Policy Partners. Brendan, I wanted to get your take on what we saw happening with the stock market this week and some of the growth opportunities.
Yeah, so we woke up on Monday morning and the market seemed to be freaking out about, you know, the Delta variant. We never exactly sure that that's what it was, but that was the narrative that was going on. Luckily, I kind of sounded smart to some of our clients because we had done a video with our friend Dr. Chris Moores, who's an epidemiologist at the GW. And he actually was much more sanguine about the Delta variant than I would have thought. He just sees that we actually do have the capability to very quickly, if needed, produce a new vaccine or an additional vaccine. And that these guys are ahead of it. As soon as a variant pops out, they're already
they're on it. Yeah.
He said it would be about 100 days for us to turn it around. And he thought that we will be able to reopen in the fall. You know, maybe you have to wear a mask at some place and not, but that, you know, the kids should go back to school and people will go back to work. So, you know, I had a call with a number of clients saying, you know, what do you think? And I said, well, if the market is freaking out about the Delta variant, I think that that'll be proven wrong, at least in the United States. The rest of the world's a different story. It unfortunately looks like we're just going to burn through. And the Delta variant, I think, is even more contagious than the official numbers are.
Norman was telling me before the show, I think it's 1,000 times more contagious.
Yeah, but even the numbers that we're collecting globally, I think much more people have had and much more high deaths. So unfortunately, I think we're going to get through this like we did in 2009 or 1919 rather than vaccinate ourselves through it.
Right.
But I also thought that, you know, hey, markets are due for corrections every now and then. So I wouldn't be shocked to have a 5% correction. And then we woke up on Tuesday and we weren't worried about anything anymore. And the markets, I mean, it's up today again. But more importantly, equity markets go up and down. But I'll let John speak to the treasury market. I think that's probably, in terms of a macro data point, that's probably a little more encouraging.
Yeah, it's certainly been the growth freakout that we saw in the equity market got all the headlines earlier this week. And as Brendan said, you know, we've been basically blaming that on the Delta variant and that getting into the headlines, but it's not a new thing. This has been building for a while. We've seen basically the last 2 months, the reflationary impulse in markets beginning to wane. And that has been not just you know, the equity index level has looked pretty steady, but underneath the surface has been this churning hydraulic, this rotation from the real economy stocks, which were benefiting from the reopening trade earlier in the year, to back to outperformance of the stocks that are that did better during the height of the pandemic, the tech stocks. And so there was even in the equity market, which looked surface level, index level, pretty steady. There was investors were beginning to bet against their rosiest scenarios in terms of reflation. It was very obvious in the treasury market. We saw, you know, longer dated treasury yields and the treasury yield curve. The treasury yield curve tends to steepen when expectations for growth and reflation are going up, and it was flattening pretty dramatically. And that flattening accelerated through the end of June and into July, and sort of culminated in a very big rally in the longer dated end of the treasury market.
And just to take a quick step back, the treasury yield curve is just a graph of where each treasury bond is trading. And you can buy a very short dated treasury bond, you know, a 3 month, or you can buy a 10 year, or you can buy a 30 year. Sure. Obviously, when you buy that, you're betting that the government is going to pay you back in 10 years. So the view of where each one of these is trading is the market's view on what the economy is going to be like at various places.
Yeah,
In the future. So that's why it can be informative of how the market is viewing the next 3 months, 6 months, 3 years, 10 years.
Yeah, and a big, deep liquid market like the trade, you can always point to some technical details. Oh, there was positioning, which people were caught offside and that sort of stuff. This is a 50 basis point move in the 10, you know, this is a huge move in the 10 year. This is futures markets pulling, you know, numerous rate hikes out of their future expectations. That's not the kind of price action that you typically associate with technicals, which tend to magnify moves maybe in the treasury market, but don't actually call, you know, persistent directionality. So we've been taking that one at face value. And that's been coming alongside, you know, rollover in some of the industrial metals and so forth, some of the other growth proxies. And so this was this kind of cathartic growth freak, you know, growth fears coming to a head on Monday was something that had been building for a while. But we saw the counter reaction in markets. And part of the reason, it's not just that, you know, the Delta variant is part of it. And, you know, the closer you look at the Delta variant, obviously, you know, the vaccines are highly effective against the Delta variant, and that is awfully good news. But, you know, there's also the fact that, you know, market participants up until this week were really scratching their heads about what the Biden administration's infrastructure
plan was going to look like
after it got through the legislative process. Was it even going to get through the legislative process? Yeah. There were a lot of doubts around that.
Still not sure.
It's true.
I think we're getting more sure.
I think we are getting more. This week
just looked a lot better on that front.
I think the odds of a bipartisan bill are, I think we're there. We got to do
some procedural things, but we basically
have the votes to get it done.
Yeah. And we've kicked this around. And I think, you know, not to pat ourselves on the back, I think all three of us at some point were saying maybe early August, maybe late August, but like around September, this will get through the Senate. It'll be 1.2 and you know, we'll see what happens over the weekend, but it feels like Monday or Tuesday.
The market got a little worried about the failed vote on Wednesday, but that I actually viewed it as a great sign because no one was freaking out about it. It was basically they were saying, we're going to vote now because we're just not, we don't have our ducks in the row, but we think maybe Monday we could be ready. You know, that was a very good sign.
And
I also think, I don't know if you agree with me, if we get a bipartisan passed bill, it basically guarantees we're getting a partisan reconciliation bill because the Democrats can't go run in 2022 on passing a Republican infrastructure bill, you know?
Yeah, I agree. And there'll be a lot of heartburn and ups and downs with the normal characters, right? The Manchin Sinemas dragging their feet. But I think we get there. And I think, you know, I was reading this morning before the show, you're seeing a lot of the progressives just like grit their teeth. They're going to vote 1.2, but you know, it's comments like, I don't see any reason to oppose it. Like there's not a lot of excitement.
Yeah. And there's actually not very much controversial stuff in this one. It actually is a bipartisan bill that most people can agree to.
Yeah. And then, you know, it's keep in mind the reconciliation one. I mean, you've got a centrist like Mark Warner and Bernie Sanders, like, locking arms on that one.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree.
That's not your full caucus. That's pretty representative of the Democratic tent in the Senate.
Yeah. And that is, so as that is brightening up and as the, you know, the optimists on the COVID outlook are feeling a little bit better about life as they inspect the data more closely this week, the other aspect that has been taking away some of the reflationary impulse in the markets over the past couple of months has been the more hawkish turn in the Fed. The Federal Reserve, and this is we'll get into this discussion with the big Fed meeting next week, but this has been a really key factor. And we've had a couple of months where the more hawkish members of the committee have really had the megaphone talking about tapering. And, yeah. You know, our
it seems
expectations
like we're heading that way. I mean, I know we won't know for sure, but next week, I mean, it seems like that's where kind of Powell's mind is. I'm curious your takes, but it seems like we're going that way.
You know, we've got this situation now in which the Delta variant has the narrative about the Delta variant has outrun the Fed's communications.
In
his testimony on Capitol Hill, in his recent testimony on Capitol Hill last week, was, you know, Powell was talking about inflation. The market has like moved on from the inflation scare. That was so like April, May, right? Markets move fast.
Yeah.
And so the, you know, it's not completely off.
But my Oreos are more expensive. So it's, you
know, right. But, you know, market-based metrics of inflation expectations have been very tame for the past number of months, basically since mid-May. And the concerns have really shifted toward the Delta variant. And the Fed has spent very little, Fed speakers have spent very little time talking about it. They have maintained the optimistic, sunny approach to the economy, that sort of weird balance between economic optimism, but acknowledgement of uncertainty, characterizing inflation as transitory and continuing their commitment to current levels of accommodation. That balance had been harder to strike, but we think that increasingly Fed officials are going to start talking about referencing the Delta variant as a key uncertainty.
Yeah.
We are all looking at this fall period, September, October, November, back to school, back to work, when the seasonals for COVID get worse at a time when, you know, the variants are on the rise. And by then we'll have a lot more information on exactly what the infrastructure bill looks like. For the Fed to get out ahead of all this and do some tightening in front of this big watershed of potential transition to a real post-pandemic phase, I think there was a realization this week that the Fed just isn't going to do that. And the center of the committee is far less likely to go along with the vociferous hawks like St. Louis Fed President Bullard and Dallas Fed President Kaplan, who are saying, you know, let's taper right now. The center of the committee just doesn't appear to be there. This is a testable, this is our view. And this is the view that the market has kind of come around to this week. It's a testable proposition. We'll find out.
And I also think the reality is if you thought that the Fed was going to start the process in September, they would have already started it now like speeches and hinting at it, you know, like it's just not going to happen. I think the earliest
August,
is November. And I think probably it's more like a December time period.
Yeah.
And then you actually do it at the end of the first quarter of next year.
Right. He has, I think Jackson Hole is going to be in person. Now,
yes, it is. Yeah. And then we had the ECB yesterday who Lagarde was able to kind of maintain the very dovish outlook. So I think 3 months ago, the market was pricing in, when you looked at futures markets and options market, they were expecting a big announcement at Jackson Hole, where I think it's just going to be a fun vacation for a bunch of economists.
Yeah, we think this is kind of when the doves grab the microphone back from the hawks and say, hey, you know, there are a lot of uncertainties out here. San Francisco Fed President Daley is the only one that's really infused the Delta variant risk with policy significance. Others have alluded to it sort of, you know, elliptically, but we think that's going to be front and center. We also think that the Fed and Chair Powell's recent comments have focused more on this. The Fed is going to be increasingly explicit about their guidance about substantial further progress, which is the condition to substantial further progress towards full employment and price stability, which is the condition that they've attached to tapering the asset purchase program, or QE. They're going to increasingly define that substantial further progress in reference to the lower socioeconomic echelons in the labor report, the impacted minority groups, which have a lot more catching up to do. We've seen some weirdness in the labor market numbers. These are
I was going to ask you about this. We saw a little spike this week in the jobless claims. I mean, is it a blip? Is it something there we need to be worried about for July?
It's a weekly number, so it's very noisy. So I wouldn't freak out about it. If we have three above 400,000, I think you can speak to that. But it's much better to look at the kind of rolling average on initial claims rather than get overly read one week to the next.
Yeah,
but it speaks to the weird cross currents that we've had in the labor market,
And it speaks to the Fed just staying cautious until you are sure that this thing is actually on solid footing.
Yeah, and back to school, back to work, that combination, they're obviously deeply interrelated, and that is going to be a huge test case in the fall. And, you know, we just don't think that the Fed is going to get out ahead of that. I think that they're going to stick to their guns and keep the dovish center of the committee through that pivotal time frame.
Yeah. I mean, as much as it feels like we're back to normal, I mean, my commute is still half of what it used to be. Still a little quiet. And we've got to, you know, the kids don't still have a vaccine, and there's a big kind of push now.
Yeah. Though at the CNN town hall, Biden, he kind of alluded to that it's coming soon for kids below 12.
Don't tell my kids
on that front.
No, I mean, I've heard the same thing coming soon, but
You know, Dr. Moore thought that it could get approved in August. If not August, then it would be September. But August would be great, because then maybe some kids could actually be ready for the start of school in September.
Yeah, right. And I agree with you, John. I think, you know, we have to see what that looks like when, you know, not whatever the number is, 10 or 20% of us are back at work, but you're back to 100% of folks who are working, back in their jobs, kids back in school, back in daycares. Like, this is the real test. Well, guys, that's what I have for this week. Did we miss anything?
I suppose the other thing we could talk about is who's going to be the next Fed president, whether the Biden administration chooses to reappoint Powell, or John and I kind of we're not making predictions or anything like that, but I think my gut tells me that they would go with Lael Brainard.
Yeah, that still seems. I mean,
not that I've heard anything, just kind of
you would get enough
pressure to, let's not appoint a white Republican.
right. Although I got to say, even as a Democrat, you know, Paul's done.
No, he's done a great job.
Through a crisis. It's I don't know how you could pass a better job interview. But I've already started to notice, even this week, I think you're financial focused progressives, your Elizabeth Warren, Sherrod Brown, like they're starting to pick at him over bank regulation and other issues, where I think there'll be a lot of pressure on Biden to make a switch. And Brainard was sort of the consensus last November, December, right after Biden. So I think you're right.
Well, she was probably going to be Treasury Secretary if Clinton had won, and that rug got pulled out quickly. And then a lot of people thought that she would actually be Treasury Secretary under Biden. And Yellen kind of came out of left field. So, you know, she's still waiting for her big job.
Governor Brainard has definitely put her, you know, she is an influential member of the committee. She has really put her views out there. She has been expressed and dissented on the bank return of capital. That was a clear putting her marker down there. And we've all heard that the choice hasn't been made, but certainly you can't, it's not a comment on his performance.
Brian, to your point, the fact that Senator Warner and Brown spoke up yesterday, the interview process is beginning.
Well, I'm sure we'll talk about that a lot in the coming weeks, but Thanks, guys, for helping me through another substitute performance for Tony. thanks, everyone, for listening to the HPS Macrocast. I'm Brian DeAngelis with Hamilton Place Strategies. Our partners, John Fagan and Brendan Walsh, are market policy partners. Hope everyone has a great weekend, and check out Norman's book, Vision, Our Strategic Infrastructure Roadmap Forward. And we'll talk to you next time on the Macrocast.
Thank you for listening to the HPS Macrocast. Please remember to subscribe, rate, and share.